Thank you for coming. Firstly, just a quick reminder, if you could turn your phone to silent if you haven't already. My name's Trevor, and on behalf of our Christian Fellowship Group here, I'd like to send a warm welcome to our speakers this evening. Sir Jeremy Cook, who's a high school judge, and Roger Carswell, who is a Christian speaker and author. This is part of a series of talks happening across the world this week under the banner of Questions of Life. It's run by Christian fellowships from different businesses around the world, supported by St. Peter's Barge. Whatever your current belief, this is a great opportunity to consider some of life's big issues: money, success, suffering, and reality. This week, Roger will be interviewing a range of people, from an ex-terrorist to a high school judge, footballer to a CEO. The flyer in the seat is all the information you need. The subject of today's talk is, does the evidence stack up? So Jeremy will be interviewed by Roger about his life and faith, and then Roger will speak. At the end, there'll be the opportunity to answer both questions about anything they've said. So now I'll head over to Roger and Sir Jeremy, and for this one.
Thank you. Well, feel free to clap, but feel free not to as well. It's really good to be with you. I'll just clamber. When you're my height, this still seems a long way up. But my name's Roger, and I'd like to interview this gentleman. And really, I don't know him very well at all, just had a few minutes. So I'm simply going to be nosy, if that's all right. And towards the end, we'll have a few minutes where you can ask anything that you think I should have asked or you'd like to ask. But now, how do I address you? Sir Jeremy, or hey you, or what do we do?
Jesuit will do.
Jesuit will do. All right. I'll keep you Jeremy, I think. All right. It's really good to have you now. High Court judge, and indeed, Sir Jeremy. Do you recall well your being knighted?
Yeah, well, it goes with the job, in fact.
Oh, so you didn't do anything to...
I didn't do
anything. All right, okay.
But High Court judges automatically get a knighted.
Right.
So when they appoint you as a High Court judge, you get an appointment to the palace.
So that's what David Beckham needs to become.
Well,
and he'd be there.
That's one way,
yeah. Yes, all right.
Yeah.
All right, so and what happens? You go to the palace?
So you go to the palace, and you have to wear morning dress and look for the party and so on, and you get taken into a reception room, and you're not allowed to have anybody with you, so your wife can't come. Interesting though, isn't it? And then you're told by the appointee what the etiquette is, and you're going to get basically knighted first of all, and then about 10 minutes to the Queen. And then she rings the bell to show she's had enough.
Is that right? She really does ring a bell.
So you go in and you go through the formulas, you kneel, and she does it without taking off your ears.
I nearly behead you, yes.
Watching the ears, stay still. And all the things you expect, arise, prefer, all this.
Yes.
Set by King Arthur and Lancelot and all that sort of stuff. And then you get 10 minutes. Chat with the queen.
And do you set the terms of the conversation, or
no,
does she?
No. The etiquette is she must begin the conversation.
All right.
So she feeds you. She was most interested at the time, in fact, with the a question about criminals. I don't know if you remember, do you remember Toby Martin? He was the farmer in
yes.
Anger,
yes.
Who shot the burglar who was on his way out. In fact, he'd been sitting at the bottom of the stairs with a shotgun. And picked this bloke up as he disappeared on the way out. And she was very interested in that. And the reason she was interested was, of course, that it wasn't much before that she had that man at the bottom of a bed for three quarters of an hour.
Right, yeah.
Do you remember this?
Yeah.
The bloke got into the palace, she had been faced with this intruder. Bottom of bed for three quarters of an hour. She obviously felt quite strongly about people who got into other people's houses.
Absolutely.
She wanted to know about criminals.
Oh,
so
right.
She said to me, she said, tell me, are criminals different from other people or not?
Huh.
See? So that led to quite an interesting
and what was your reply?
Well, I said, not really, because the bottom line is that they have the same temptations to do wrong. And possibilities of doing good, but of course their temptations on the whole are much, much stronger than those we face, because many of them come from really difficult backgrounds and have drug problems and so what else. But there was the basic question of human evil and how that comes about. And I was saying, well, actually, we're all in the same boat, because we all have the same tendency to do wrong.
So you're really saying, Your Majesty, you're a sinner?
Well, indeed, and she didn't differ from that at all.
Right.
No, she didn't have any problems with that. She's, I think she's a real believer.
Yes, yes.
So we had quite an interesting conversation about that.
But she rang the bell at what point?
Well, I think we got on to something else back then that wasn't quite so interesting. I think we ran out of things to say at that
Fascinating.
Point.
Fascinating. Now, High Court Judge. So you have all the garb and the wig and the,
well,
the red...
I've retired, you see.
And you're not allowed to keep them?
Well, I could, but what do you do with the Father Christmas outfit?
I think you answered your question.
You could wear it on Christmas Eve.
Yes, you could.
But in fact, I bought my second or third hat, that it was wearing out by the time I'd done my 15 years.
Really?
So
15 years as a High Court judge and a barrister, QC, etc. before that.
Yeah.
There must be some, Jeremy, there must be some cases that really stand out in your memory bank.
Well, there are probably two that would interest people here. I've been burnt in effigy twice, in my time, and the second occasion was in Karachi, and that's because I tried the Pakistani cricketers who were done for spot fixing.
Remember,
a few years back, your cricket fan, you would have followed that, and they'd be taking money in order to bowl no balls for betting advantages in the Far East, and in due course they got sentenced. So that's one thing that tends to interest people. But as this is a financial lot around here, I assume for the most part, I spent most of my life in the commercial court, so I've done an awful lot with regard to derivatives and foreign exchange and all the sort of stuff you see, and mis-selling, of course, that sort of business. And indeed, I tried the first LIBOR banker who was convicted of fixing the LIBOR rate. And some of you may have had some dealings with that sort of thing. Basically, I've seen a lot of the city scams, all the things that have gone wrong, and how the number of criminals around here in the city. And I've always said there's not necessarily a huge difference between doing the criminal stuff, which you have on the one hand, and the commercial stuff on the other. It's just that the commercial boys are a lot more sophisticated in the way they set about being dishonest.
You're widely reported in the press, and this is sort of moving a little bit onto your Christian experience. When Stephen Sims, the MP, was stabbed, and you found the accused guilty.
But I didn't find the accused.
Oh, right, the jury did. All right, okay. Yes, that's right. Are you able to sort of direct the jury in any...
No, absolutely not.
You're not at all.
No,
but do you in practice?
No.
No, okay, all right.
No. It's a very important point.
Yes.
You have to do it straight down the middle.
Right.
A judge's job is to sum up the evidence fairly, so what it is they've heard, remind them of the points that are at issue, and say, now, here are the questions you have to answer. This is a matter for you, as the jury, to determine. And if you think I formed an opinion about it, you ignore it. I mean, I say that every time.
Now, just on that, sorry, I want to come back to the question in a moment, but on that, you must have formed an opinion. How many times, what percentage of trials have you had where you feel the jury disagreed in their conclusion with the one that you'd got?
Well, I think a High Court judge is quite fortunate in this sense that they get really only very serious cases.
Right.
So the police take their time and trouble to get the evidence together.
Yes.
And the result is that what goes before the jury is usually pretty convincing. And I don't think there's only once that I've done a serious trial where I thought the jury didn't get it quite right.
And which way did they? Were they more lenient than you would have been, or the other way around?
They found the man guilty of manslaughter,
yes,
but I thought he was plainly guilty of murder.
All right, interesting. Now, going back to Stephen Sims, and then in your summing up and sentencing, you said some things that were quite well taken up by the press, weren't they?
Yes.
Tell us what you said, because it's interesting.
Well, I don't remember this. He's an MP up in East Ham, not very far from here. And he was stabbed in his surgery by an Islamic extremist. Not a very old girl. She was about 20, 21, university student, educated. And she'd been listening to podcasts and so on from various extreme Islam preachers who were advocating jihad. And she turned up in the surgery and literally walked up to the MP and stabbed him in the stomach. And fortunately, he survived.
Mm.
So it was an attempted murder rather than a murder. And she wouldn't recognise the court at all, so she didn't turn up to a trial. She stayed in prison, and it was videoed to her in prison. She had lawyers who represented her in court, and presented her case, but there wasn't really very much to say, because it'd been seen by many people, including the MP himself, Gay of Eversleigh, about it, and the MP's secretary and so on. And some of you may know Stephen Timms is in fact a lovely Christian man. And when it came to sentencing, I thought it was the right thing to do when talking about a hate crime, was to point out the difference between Islamic extremism on the one hand and Christian views, upon which the society has been in part based, at least over the last few hundred years. And so I talked about the difference between hate leading to attempted murder, and on the other, the Christian viewpoint of loving God, loving your neighbour, loving the foreigner in the land, and indeed loving those who hold themselves out as your enemies. And the newspapers thought that was not the sort of thing a judge ought to be saying.
Really? You weren't reprimanded by anybody?
There was a complaint made to the judicial complaints board, but they slung it out straight away, I'm glad to say.
Good.
On the basis that because this was a hate crime, this was an appropriate thing to say.
Fascinating. Now, your Christian convictions, tell us a little bit about your sort of spiritual journey to the point where you became a Christian.
Well, I'm one of those people who traces it back to sort of teenage years. And I guess as a 14 and 15 year old, I was going through the usual angst that teenagers go through. What is life about? None of this makes sense at all. And I was convinced, in fact, of the truth of Christianity, having been brought up to go to church and so on. And the real question was, what was I going to do about it? But to my mind, when I stopped and thought about the resurrection, for example, there was no other rational explanation other than that Jesus really did rise from the dead. I see we had a thing here about evidence, but I give talks about the evidence for the resurrection.
Yeah, I'll come on to that in a moment. I'd like to, if I may.
But there's a second element, which was, even when you come convinced of the truth of it, there's always this question of will. Are you going to commit yourself to live by it? If Jesus is who he says he is, is that really going to impact on you? And what really, I think, drew me was seeing a few people who were a little bit older than I was, who were living out Christian lives. So they were university undergraduates for the most part. But they were people who were so obviously committed, convinced Christians in the way they lived, and they showed. And I thought, they're right. If this is true, that's the way you've got to go. You've got to give your life to Christ and live for him. So that's what I've tried to do.
So as a teenager, you put your trust in Jesus Christ, and obviously that's a few years ago now, but you talked about evidence. I think most people in Britain today would sort of go along with the idea, the notion that, yes, Jesus lived and therefore he must have died. The idea of him rising from the dead, well, one bishop famously called it a conjuring trick with bones. Do you remember that? And it's a really historical evidence that, the, as it were, the body that went into the tomb, that dead, came out alive.
Well, I was giving a talk on this last night.
Oh, were you? All right.
Yeah. But, and I started by eating two daffodils. Have you heard this talk before?
Well, I'm not going to do that, but tell me about it.
But the point is this. I start off by eating two daffodils, and then I say to people, if you went back to your flat tonight and you told your flatmate that the High Court judge was a speaker ate a daffodil, or two daffodils, they'd believe that. But if you and someone else did, or if four or five people did, or if 20 people did, or if 500 people, who are all thought to be reliable and honest and you knew were consistent people of integrity, and they all said the same thing, then you'd begin to think it happened. And the truth of it is, that's what evidence is. It's simply what people have said they've seen and heard. And when you're looking at questions of history, it's exactly the same. You're exploring records to see what it is that people say they saw and heard. And you evaluate it, and you look at contrary evidence, and you decide what is the most coherent explanation. And I honestly believe that anybody who looks at the records in the Gospels and just treats them not as infallible, but treat them simply as records of people who were there and what they said at the time, and evaluate it, and you come up with a conclusion. The tomb was certainly empty. Everybody agreed about that, whether they were for Jesus or against him. It was the only other explanation for him not rising from the dead was the body had been stolen. And if you explore the options, now who would have stolen, how could it have happened, with a guard and everything else, none of it makes any sense. Unless in the end you come to the conclusion, yeah, he really did rise from the dead. So if you never looked at that, read a gospel or two. In fact, read all four gospels, just the last three or four chapters of each. Take about 20 minutes probably. And there's the evidence.
And certainly if Jesus rose from the dead, he is totally unique. Nobody else has ever done this. All right, so you became a Christian those years ago. Were you drawn into the law? I don't know, did you study law at university?
I did, yeah.
And then immediately became a barrister, or, you know, after the trial?
I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. In those days, people sort of went to university and they did a good degree without having any clear idea what was going to happen next.
Right.
And in fact, I became a solicitor first before becoming a barrister. But I spent a lot of time trying to get out of the law. I wasn't sure this was the right place at all. But as time went on, I became more and more convinced that actually God wanted me out there, as I put it, in the muck of life. Because what you see as a lawyer is the mess ups that people make. Mm. Particularly if you're a litigating lawyer, you see the mess that people make of their lives. I thought being a Christian out there and trying to do something about that mattered. Because justice, in the end, is about trying to put things right. It's not about punishment, it's about putting things right. Punishment is part of it.
Yes, I was just saying, you believe in punishment. There is a place for punishment.
Absolutely, yes.
But what about justice? Because, interesting, the Bible certainly teaches that God is a just God. But his justice is based on infinite knowledge, on omniscience. Right. We don't have that, do we?
No, I'm afraid we get it wrong from time to time. Mm. Our justice is inevitably rotten ready. We're human. Jurors are human. Witnesses are human. People can make mistakes. And judges are human and they make mistakes. And one has to recognise that. But the great thing is that we know God will get it 100% right.
Do you think there is something, I don't know, is the fact that God is a just God, does that explain the desire for justice within humanity? Because wherever you go in the world, you will have trials of some sort or another, won't you? There is a sort of, even little children say that's not fair. There's a sort of an innate belief in justice.
Yes, if you ask anybody if they want justice,
yes,
they will say yes. They particularly want it if they feel they're being hard done by the
church. Yes, they've been denied it, yes.
But everybody has this innate sense of wanting life to be just, wanting it to be fair. And as you say, the example of the child who says, it's not fair. And the standard parental response is, life.
No,
isn't fair.
That.
And yet, instinctively, we all feel it ought not to be like that. Mm. Life ought not to be unfair. And when you stop and ask, why is that? Because if we're really just a product of evolutionary chance, why should anybody be in the slightest bit concerned about this? Survival of the fittest, selfish gene, all that sort of thing. Justice is completely irrelevant, has nothing to do with it. And indeed, if you talk to Dawkins, that's what he says in his books.
He
says in very clear terms, it's a nonsense, doesn't make any sense at all. And yet, of course, if there is a God, and he's a just God, and he's made us in his image to be a bit like him, it's not surprising at all that we all have this innate sense that we want justice, we'd like to see it done.
Mm. Now, if God is the ultimate judge, he has the right, and especially as he is pure and perfect, he has the right to punish. Now, presumably, you've sentenced people to whatever. Does it give you nightmares? Do you go to bed at night thinking, oh dear, that man's in prison today because of what I said, and he's going to be there for the next X years because of what... Does that bother you?
Well, I'm afraid it doesn't very much.
Because
I'm personally, in my own mind, very comfortable with the fact that people who've been convicted by a jury, not by me, I do the sentencing, but they do the convicting. They having been rightly convicted. And there is an appeals system in case things go wrong.
Yes.
I mean, it's a horrifying thing, I have to say. I mean, I recall sentencing a 22-year-old who had been involved in a drug war, and he killed three people with a Kalashnikov, run out of ammunition, and had a go at two others with a knife. So it was three murders and two attempted murders. 22-year-old, sentenced him to life imprisonment. And you probably know life imprisonment doesn't mean life. Such, but the way the system works is the judge sets a minimum term that they have to serve before they're eligible for parole. So in his case, it was 42 years.
Wow.
So it's a 22-year-old whose life will be spent in prison till he's 64. Now that is terrible, terrible waste of life.
Isn't it? It is, absolutely.
And you know, I'm not sure that it's a very humane form of punishment, but. The essence of being human is you do have to take responsibility for your actions.
and punishment is therefore appropriate. Whether you think that's the best form of punishment is another question. But the options are quite limited. What else do you do?
Interesting. As a Christian, do you pray about your job? You know you're going to go and sit up there in this elevated position, say in a high court. Do you pray for wisdom, for ability to act with justice? What sort of things do you cover you in your prayers?
But before I would go into court, I would pray for everybody in my court. So I would pray for the lawyers. I would pray for the accused, if it was a criminal case. Mm. I'd pray for the parties, if it's an argument about money. And I would pray simply that justice would be done. Mm. And that I'd do my bit in it.
Are you known as a Christian amongst your fellow judges?
Pray so, yes.
And what's their reaction? Because some of them do come across as sort of grumpy cynics, don't they?
Yes, I think that's right. The judges in this country are fairly libertarian, not really.
Right.
Liberal in outlook, I would say.
Yes. Is there a reason for that?
No, I don't know why.
No, all right.
Education, all sorts of things go into that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
They all have a very strong sense of justice.
Right.
They really do. Some of you probably watch John Dean. Anybody watch John Dean? Are you prepared to admit that? And although he's an utterly disreputable figure, wasn't he? You know, sleeping with the witnesses, with the counsel, with anybody. He did our image a lot of good as judges, because the one thing that came across was that he was really concerned to do justice, wasn't he? Regardless of what the executive had to say, the influencer, he wanted justice to be done. And by and large, judges do want that. They are, on the whole, therefore, people of honesty and integrity, and they're not corrupt. And that's a fantastic thing, because two-thirds of the world judges are corrupt. You know, and we're in that one-third or so.
Have you ever been offered bribes? Never happened once.
It's almost impossible to conceive of how it would happen.
Because there's no access to a judge.
Because it's difficult to get a judge, and the ethos is such that any barrister or lawyer who approached a judge would know he was almost immediately elected, struck off.
Really?
Yeah.
Really. But what about intimidation from, I don't know, relatives of the accused? Nobody's ever threatened your wife or your children or anything?
No. One does have police protection on occasions, but
right.
Normally it doesn't need to last for very long. Again, the great advantage of the jury system is that there are 12 people who are making the real decision about guilt.
Mm.
And although jury nobbling goes on, it's usually to try and influence the decision before it's taken. You don't see juries being victimised afterwards, by and large, as regarded as part of the system. So, in that sense.
And how else does being a Christian impact your job? You're known as a Christian, presumably you share something of your faith with other judges when you have opportunity, etc. You pray for each member of the court. But any other ways in which specifically being a Christian impacts the way you do your job?
Well, as I said, I don't think it impacts in a very obvious way, because most judges, as I say, have a keen desire for justice, and the law is there to be applied, and it's the same law that falls to be applied.
Mm.
But I would hope that I didn't come across as one of those curmudgeonly, difficult judges. And the way I treated people, therefore, would be different. And in particular, the difference, I think, would show when I sentenced someone. Because you will all have read in the newspapers judges sentencing remarks where they say to the criminal, "You are the most wicked man in the world," and so on and so forth. And I would never say that. What I would always say is, "You have done various evil things that require that you should be punished and dealt with. But I'm not pointing the finger at you and saying you're different from me. Because we're all in the same boat, sir." The same point I was making at the outset. We all have the tendency to do wrong.
Mm.
And his temptations may be different from mine.
Mm.
And he may have given in a way
so
that society regards
as. Do you sometimes feel sorry for the accused?
I think there's a degree of that sometimes.
Mm. Interesting.
The crimes vary so much between the absolutely blatant and deliberate malicious crime and the old-fashioned murder where people lose control. I could tell you some quite sad stories of murders where I did feel a degree of compassion, both obviously for the victim and the family, but also for the person concerned.
Now, time's gone, but I want to ask you one other question, which I think is quite a big one, and it ties in with what I want to share to round things off. It's sort of basic to Christian belief that, yes, as you say, we've all sinned. That's Christian terminology. We've all done wrong. We've broken God's commandments. We deserve judgment. We're under condemnation. But Jesus has come, lived this perfect life, the Son of God, who has then died and, as a substitute, taken our punishment on himself. Now, for me as a Christian, I think that's the most wonderful truth. But not you now as a Christian, but you as a judge, if you could separate the two. How does that appeal to you? Does it jar? Does it not seem right?
Yeah. I mean, it's inconceivable, isn't it, to think of a judge getting out of his wig and his robes and wandering down to the dock and taking the punishment of the criminal. I mean, you just can't see that happen.
No, it wouldn't hit the headlines, would it?
It isn't going to happen.
No.
So there have been cases of one or two magistrates paying fines on behalf of...
I wonder if you could give me their addresses later.
not speeding.
Oh, all right.
So that's inconceivable. But the clear point is that it's... We're talking here about God taking upon himself all the consequences of evil. And... he's in a unique position to do that, isn't he? One, he can judge perfectly. Two, he has this enormous love for those people who made a mess of things. And he's prepared to take all the blame himself. And I just do think that is an astonishing, both, it's a mysterious thing, isn't it?
It is.
It's a mysterious thing, but it's also an absolutely fascinating thing. But there's a God who loves me enough to do that for me.
But you certainly don't think he's unjust.
No, because it's him taking the responsibility.
He's satisfying his own justice, isn't he?
Yes. So there's not an issue. No, justice stems from him.
Interesting.
And he said, I'll take all that into myself.
Yes,
that's what the cross does.
I wonder, anybody, any questions you'd like to ask to Jeremy? There'll be an opportunity at the very end as well, but anybody like to? No.
Just your redemption. The Christian message is on redemption. Yeah. Everyone has that possibility.
Yeah.
As a judge and a sentencing, that's sort of come across in the US. Obviously, a lot of people say, oh, that guy deserves 40 years.
Can we just repeat the question, just for those at the back? So it's a question about redemption, that obviously Christians believe in redemption. As a judge, is there a feeling that, possibility of giving redemption, as it were, to one of the victims? Is that one of the accused, rather? Sorry.
Yes. Sending people to prison doesn't present a huge opportunity for that, except that there are some very strong Christian groups in prison. And I know of people, certainly, who have been set to prison, who have become Christians in consequence. And I'll just tell you one very brief story, which is an unusual story in the streets, but I've got three or four.
Yes, please. Yes.
It's a story about a man who brutalised his wife. He used to abuse her and beat her up until she left him. And he would keep finding out where she was and getting her back. Mm. And after this has gone on two or three times, she eventually leaves and disappears, and he doesn't know where she's gone. So he arranges for the kidnapping of her brother. And in doing that, he recruits two lads who are 18 years old, who go to a school not all that far from here, he said. And they kidnap the man, put him in the car, and drive him off. And then the lads are paid off for what they've done. They've been told that it's a debt that's owed, and all he's trying to do is get some money back. And the man, the husband, with a couple of accomplices, then tortured the brother in order to try and find out where the wife is living. And I don't know whether they simply overdid it or whether he wouldn't say anything, but the end result is they did. And have you got strong stomachs?
We'll find out.
Right, well, it's a commonplace these days, perhaps much more often you think they cut the body in half in the bathroom, they carry it out in carpets, and because one of the accomplices works as a butcher, they chop it up for little pieces of butchers, and they take off the pieces and they throw them into the River Thames a couple of miles down the road from here. About a week later, a couple of days later perhaps it is, there's a security guard, and he is standing outside the premises, which he meant to guard, and sees the car park in front of him, and a seagull flies over and drops something. He wanders off to see what it is. Yes, you go on, yes. It's a thumb. And the thumbprint was known to the priest. It was the thumbprint of the victim, who by then, of course, had been reported as missing. And the police then embark on trying to work out what happened, and with a bit of video evidence, they can plot the car journeys with some phone evidence, they can pick up the conversations that have taken place, they pick up the story of the brutality of the husband and wife and so on and so forth, and they gradually piece the whole thing together. And they eventually get all the defendants together, and the matter comes to trial. Each of the defendants, including the two lads, has come forward with a version of events that bears, in my judgment, little or no relation to the truth at all, until they get to court. And then one of these lads, he gets onto the witness box, and he says, "I've just sworn an oath on the New Testament to tell the truth, and that's what I'm going to do."
Hmm?
And he spills the beans for the first time
in
the witness box, much to the horror, of course, of all the defendants who've been properly implicated by it. And what emerged from it was this was a lad who'd been brought up by a Christian mother, no father, but a mother who was a Christian. And during his time sitting in prison waiting trial, he'd been stopping and thinking about things. And he gets convicted of kidnapping, of course. I'm able to treat him more leniently because he's confessed, and then to put him in touch with some Christian organisations, and he's a lad who's come to faith in Jesus. So, within the context of what looks like a terrible mess, God has in fact brought something rather good out of it, and this man has been redeemed, to use the technical term.
That's a wonderful note on which to finish. Thank you very much. Shall we